Welcome in. Good to have you here on a Friday, 6:05. And I'm riding solo today, so it's good to be here. Good to have you with me. You know, I have been maintaining for quite some time. You know, the Red Wings have not been where they should be, especially this far along in Steve Yzerman's tenure as the general manager of this organization. And God love Dylan Larkin. I absolutely love the story. Local kid, University of Michigan, plays for his hometown team, ascends to the captaincy. It's a fairy tale. Except very rarely do stories like this always pan out the way that you'd like. I mean, we have two of these stories going on in our town right now with Dylan Larkin and Aiden Hutchinson. It's incredible. But yesterday we get reports from Elliot Friedman at Hockey Night in Canada and Darren Dreger at Sportsnet that Dylan Larkin has requested a trade after 11 years with this organization. Now, there hasn't been any sort of confirmation of this from Dylan Larkin himself, from his representation, from the team, but it sounds like Dylan Larkin is ready to find some new pastures here. Now, he's 30 years old. He's got an $8 million a year deal, essentially, through the beginning of the 2030s. And it stinks, but I do wonder. I mean, I don't blame Dylan Larkin. I don't blame him. It makes a lot of sense for him because if you watch him in some of these international events that they have, whether that's the Olympics, whether that's that four world tournament that they had a couple of years ago. I mean, Dylan Larkin is a leader. Dylan Larkin is a winner. He wants to win. I don't know that he is a number one center, which is the position he has to carry on this team. I think if you look at where his statistical average is, he's probably a second line center. You know, he doesn't have the production of elite goal scorers in the NHL. We don't know exactly what he's looking for here, except for the fact that he wants, it sounds like he wants out, according to these reports. And I don't blame him one iota. Now, here's the other part, is we don't know in terms of where he wants to go or what he's looking for, but he does have a no-trade clause, a full no-trade clause in his deal, which means he has the control on where he goes. Although Steve Yzerman doesn't really operate that way. He doesn't abdicate that type of power to players. Steve Yzerman is going to hold out for a pretty good deal. So what kind of stalemate that could create, I don't know. We'll see. All I know, it is a bummer that it does feel like the end of an era to a certain degree. You know, the fact that, you know, we couldn't get it done here with Dylan Larkin. But we'll talk about that more as the show goes on. Also, it was an overnight hall, a votorama for senators in Washington, D.C. They passed a roughly $70 billion immigration enforcement package. It was an all-nighter. And this was backed by Donald Trump. And this is funding for ICE. This is funding for CBP over the next 3 years. And it's a win for Donald Trump and Republicans in the Senate, who said that this was necessary after they finally, after weeks and weeks and weeks, finally agreed to fund DHS as a whole, except for ICE and CBP. Well, now reconciliation, they get it done. Democrats couldn't filibuster this thing. And now it's going to move to the next location. But here's what it didn't do, because there were some real debates on over what this was actually going to include. It included the $1 billion ballroom project. They scrapped it. Also, the anti-weaponization fund, which nearly derailed the legislation, hasn't been touched. So there are Republicans that are raising concerns about how this money is going to be spent. And certainly Democrats, rightfully so, should capitalize on some of these issues that Republicans are dealing with. But CBP, ICE gets the funding. All of the other stuff his kid's going to continue to be fought over for weeks and weeks on end. Meanwhile, interesting story that Detroit home values have undergone a dramatic turnover over the last 10 years. The typical home is worth now more than twice what it was in 2016 here in the city of Detroit. The data cited in this report, that was a Zillow report, that median home values are up or were in the roughly $30,000 range, now up to $75,000. Detroit, according to this study, is one of the fastest growing large housing markets in the country during that span. Again, you go back 15 years ago, Detroit was in a really rough way. I mean, we're bankruptcy and bleak with no real path forward, it looked like. And now, we got Gucci downtown. It's absolutely crazy. Never in my life did I think we'd see an Apple store and Tim Cook downtown opening. You never thought you'd see the NFL draft downtown. And so the fact that the housing markets are picking, are keeping up with that, it tells you that people are wanting to come here. It tells you that people are interested. It tells you that there aren't necessarily people being left behind. It's now expanding on who is being helped, where the attention is going to. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And, you know, there aren't any other cities that can claim that type of growth. And again, with how the city has grown, it's pretty unbelievable. Tigers had the night off, so they could not break that 3-game win streak. How about that? That is pretty good. It's pretty good. And now they got a home stretch with the Mariners starting tonight, 6:40, coming off a sweep of the Tampa Bay Rays. And Framber Valdez is going tonight. Jason, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Did you expect him to step up in a more meaningful way?
Yeah, he is. He's been very underwhelming.
He's very underwhelming. His ERA is like almost 4.40. He just has not pitched great. And it's been really disappointing because you brought him in. I mean, really, I think you brought him in because you eventually thought that there would be a life without Tarek Skubal. And then he is going to be your number one.
So right.
You sign him to a multi-year deal, that whole thing.
And he's not a number one.
Well, he has not been a number one for certain.
And I don't think he was when he was in Houston. He's a good pitcher. But, yeah, the ERA's got to go down. 4.40, too high. He is better than that. His career numbers are better than that.
Sure,
so.
Sure. But again, it's what have you done for me lately? And lately has been bad. It's been really, not bad. It's been underwhelming.
Yes.
Where you'd like it to be a little higher, especially with
Starts
Skubal
tonight.
On.
Starts yeah. tonight.
That's called a winning streak.
Oh, look at this guy. Let's go. You know,
keep
this,
it going, Tigers.
This was sold as a revenue windfall. So why is it in Michigan that we're coming up short on our marijuana taxes? It's next on JR Morning. So riddle me this. You guys know I ain't no mathematician. I can barely help my son with his second grade math. It's a real travesty. But Michigan's new 24% wholesale marijuana tax that was designed to help fund road repairs is bringing in significantly less than what we expected it to. And why is that? Well, let's talk about it. Beth LeBlanc, the reporter at the Detroit News, joins us to talk about it. Beth, good morning. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Why is it that we are seeing a 67% less gathering of this tax revenue from this new wholesale tax on marijuana than we expected?
Yeah, so in the first quarter of the year, the Treasury Department says they've collected about $34 million in wholesale tax on the marijuana wholesale. What they were supposed to collect is about $100 million because House Fiscal Agency analysis has said it should bring in about $420 million a year. So they're running far below projections for the first quarter, at least. And it's anybody's guess why that's happening. Now, the industry will tell you that, and they've been warning since the start, that if you put this additional wholesale tax on marijuana, you're going to have people not wanting to buy the really high tax marijuana and going to a legal means to buy their marijuana. And so they're saying this is kind of proof positive that that is happening. The state is saying it's a little too early to tell whether there's more illegal activity than there once was. But it's not really clear to me why this is happening. The other thing that we might be seeing, and some of the industry has been saying that to prepare for the wholesale tax, they made a lot of purchases beforehand, mm-hmm. So that those purchases, like, you know, from grower to processor to cultivator or what have you, so that they'll be exempt from the wholesale tax. So they might be running through that marijuana now. But what we can see, even from separate statistics out of the Cannabis Regulatory Agency, is that marijuana sales as a whole in the first quarter are down from 2024 and 2025. So it might be, you know, just a weird coincidence, or it might be what they're arguing, that this is proof that folks are going to illegal means instead of sticking with the legal market.
Yeah, and that was my question, is where are these people going? I have a hard time believing that they've just stopped. They've said, we're gonna be done here. So it does feel like they're going in different ways. What is the backup plan if this money doesn't end up showing up? And to your point, I think it's fair to say, well, they had a lot of upfront costs, and we may see a different number, a different percentage of that money coming in the next quarter. But that I don't think that provides any real hope that we're going to get to those numbers that we need to help fund the roads, for example.
Yeah. I mean, you know, definitely the thing that makes me think that's not the case is the fact that sales also across the board are down over the first quarter, not just this wholesale tax. But yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. Like, what happens? I would assume that we just have less money for roads, that, you know, there's only so many places that they can pull that money if they fall short in this marijuana tax. And it's a good question right now, especially as the legislature and the governor are negotiating next year's budget, which mm-hmm. will include a placeholder for that tax money to go toward roads. And if they are getting less revenue than they expected from that, it's going to be a real issue moving forward.
Well, and it's problematic for them, because we were talking to leaders up on Mackinac Island, for example, and they were touting kind of the bipartisan efforts that it took to get this road funding deal. It was the most lucrative road funding deal that we've had in Michigan's history. We have, I mean, year after year after year underfunded our roads, and we see it every single day. And so they were touting this kind of bipartisan work for getting this deal done, and it's still falling short.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a lot of folks who are listening have to kind of understand how they make these predictions of how much it's going to bring in, right? There are fiscal agencies within the House and the Senate who are usually dead on, right? Like, they've been looking at tax revenue for longer than I've been alive, mm-hmm. and they understand how it's going to come in, and they're surprised by very little. But the thing about marijuana, and the thing even about gambling in Michigan, or you know, in sports betting or online gambling, which was legalized around the same time marijuana was, is that they were dealing with a whole new revenue stream, and it's a relatively new revenue stream. It's only been around for like 6 or 7 years. So they're trying to make predictions based on a revenue stream that they have relatively less experience with. So that's the problem with taxing these new things like online gambling or sports betting or marijuana, is that we don't have as much familiarity with this market and how it will react to something like a wholesale tax.
It's a great point, but it's also a revenue stream that's unpredictable. Because, you know, yes. You know that when you go to fill up your gas, you're going to have to pay a certain percentage of that goes to the taxes. And that is baked in. What you don't know is how people are, or how frequently people are going on their apps and betting on a particular game, or how much they're betting on a particular game, or what their winnings are, or how many people are going to a marijuana dispensary to buy product. So it to your point with the lagging sales and just the unpredictability, it's a completely different tax revenue stream for them, which seems like is why it's so difficult to nail down. It's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and they probably could have, you know, if there wasn't there, it is just very, very difficult to nail down. And the other thing about this wholesale tax is it's not just based on consumption. It's based on the movement of that marijuana between, you know, cultivator, processor, grower. So that kind of tax is more difficult than just I'm paying a 6% sales tax when I check out. It definitely shows up on your receipt at the end, but it's more difficult to understand how this is all moving through the system.
Really interesting. Beth LeBlanc, thank you. We appreciate your coverage of this, and it's something we're going to continue watch. Obviously, you know, we've got a lot of road repairs that need to be made here in the state of Michigan, and we're counting on this money. Thank you for your time this morning. Have a good weekend.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Coming up on the other side, the newest episode of Jamie's podcast, Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way, is out. And we're going to give you a piece of that podcast. Jamie's doing well. I was texting with her yesterday. She's moved on to a more demanding type of chemo drug now. And she said she's tired, but she's feeling pretty good, which was good news. So we're going to hear from Jamie coming up next on her latest episode of her podcast. That's coming up on JR Morning. All right, the new episode is out. Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way. And this week, Jamie talks to Laura Varon Brown. She's the executive director and CEO of Gilda's Place of Metro Detroit, and about how Gilda's Place is where cancer patients can go for the support that they need. It was started by the late Gilda Radner of SNL fame. And there are many locations around the country, and Gilda's Place provides support for cancer patients of all ages. It is a wonderful place. Jamie took a tour of their Metro Detroit facilities. Here's a bit of that conversation.
I started this podcast because I wanted people to feel less alone. Maybe my story can help others. And that's kind of the message from Gilda Radner way back when, and how there's a Gilda's Club Metro Detroit, and how everyone is just trying to find purpose and meaning and comfort and community during these dark times. And that's what Gilda's Club Metro Detroit does. And I'm joined by Laura Varon Brown, the CEO. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
It seems like we're all rowing the boat in the same direction here of just trying to get through it, survive it. And you guys have some wonderful programming here.
Yep. Many, many years ago, when Gilda, as a young woman, was diagnosed, she found a little yellow house in California because she felt like she didn't understand her disease. She didn't have any confidence in her disease. And she felt like people weren't telling her everything. So she snuck away to a counselor, Joanna Bull, many years ago. And then after Gilda went into remission, she said to people, everybody needs a place. Everyone needs a place to understand their disease, to talk about their disease, and to take control of the disease and to feel like they are empowered. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with Gilda's Club. After Gilda passed away, everyone kept saying, how do we honor this amazing woman? And they kept going back to what she said was everybody needs a place. And then I think someone, Joanna Bull probably, or maybe Michael Radner, said Gilda's Club, because Gilda also said that cancer gave her a membership to an elite club, and that no one ever wanted to be a member of. Mm-hmm. So that's where we get kind of the members in the club.
And so they did this in New York City. Mm-hmm. And then there was a group of women in Metro Detroit said, maybe we could do it here.
Yes. There was a group of 8 women who were experiencing cancer themselves, or they had a family member who had cancer. And they too were trying, and this was 30, almost 40 years ago when they started this inception. And they weren't getting the information. They didn't, this was before there was as much transparency as there is now. But so they thought we need to have some kind of resource gathering where we can understand this. And then they read about Gilda's Club New York City and how they were starting that, and they were about ready to break ground. And so one of them flew out there to see what that was all about. And they said, absolutely, open up another Gilda's Club, and then we'll just start to spread this information around the country.
And so they did. And we're at this beautiful house here in Royal Oak. That is the epicenter. But there are Gilda's Clubs all over the country now.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We're under the umbrella of the cancer support community. Gilda went to a place called the Wellness Community when she was in California. And then there was a merger of equals, I think in 2007, under the umbrella of the cancer support community. So between Gilda's Clubs and the cancer support community, there are probably over 50 individual locations, but then each location can have a satellite like we do in Grosse Pointe, and then we have another satellite in Detroit. Okay. So there are a couple hundred between hospital partnerships and other areas. So there's lots of resource centers around.
That's great. Okay. So if you were describing to folks listening, who comes to Gilda's Club? Who gets a membership?
Membership is pretty simple. It's a diagnosis or caring for someone, a loved one or a friend who has been diagnosed. So it's anyone who is looking for what's next, what's now. And sometimes that's a support group. Support groups aren't for everyone, but sometimes someone just comes and all I want is a support group. We also have education where you can come to understand whether it's side effects, new medications, where the resources are, alternative treatments. So we have education track. We have all kinds of support groups. We also have art and meditation and kind of that unspoken support that you can come in and get. So it's anyone who has that where they just think they need a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially right when you get that diagnosis, mm-hmm. that's when you feel the most alone. Like, how can this be happening to me? And maybe people could come here and find people who are like-minded, who are going through the same thing. That's awesome.
Yeah. You know, you're in a doctor's office and you know that you're in the room, you hear those words, you have cancer, there's 20 people in the waiting room waiting, and your mind doesn't ask all those questions right away. You just, when you get home, you're like, oh my gosh, I should have asked this. What about this? What about that? And between us and the hospital system, we can get those answers for you and we can help point you in the right direction.
Wonderful conversation. The all the wonderful work that Gilda's Place does. Really, really good conversation with Jamie and Laura Von Braun. Head on over to any of the places where you get your podcast. You can go to WJR on YouTube and see it there as well. A wonderful
the video is really cool. Jamie does a tour of the place. They have a really cool kitchen.
Yeah.
The food they make, yoga classes, really nice.
Again, it's the support system. It's the support, because look, Jamie's blessed. She has a wonderful family. She has a loving husband, a daughter, parents, lots of friends. We are all in her corner, right? You listening, following along on her journey. She has a wonderful support system, and I don't think I'm talking out of turn for her. There are people, though, that don't have that type of support system. And so there are like Gilda's Place is a wonderful example, places where you can go and find that support. And it's beautiful to see that we have those types of those outlets here for people battling the scourge of a disease. So make sure you listen to that. And we're hoping Jamie's going to join us on Monday. And, we'll check in with her this weekend, see how she's feeling. But she is doing well, which is the good news. Meanwhile, I've been following this story out of Maine, and, you know, we're not voting for Graham Plattner. That's not something that we have to do here in the state of Michigan. But it does feel like the Democrats have a bit of a problem because, for example, The View. Take The View, for example. Sonny Hostin goes on this tirade of this guy being an anti-Semitic person. You know, he had the Nazi tattoo that he eventually had covered up, called him a racist, a bigoted, a sexist, all of these terrible things. And then she says, but I would hold my nose and pull the lever for him if I lived in Maine, because Democrats need to restore some sort of democracy back to Washington. And that is a wild 180 to make. And by the way, I don't think Sonny Hostin is unique in that. I think there are a lot of Democrats that feel that way, that feel like by any means necessary, you got to get control of these chambers. And to me, it's laughable on its face that would be the takeaway. The takeaway being, it doesn't matter, don't care, as long as they have a D in front of their name, that's who you got to vote for. And quite frankly, it's insulting to voters. Like, you don't think the good people of Maine are smart enough or free thinkers to be able to think for themselves? To me, it's absolutely crazy. But we are, that's where we're at now. It didn't always used to be that way. It was a completely different one. And we're coming up on the 250. And I am so fascinated by the people who built this country, the forward thinkers, the people that were at the heart of creating this grand new experiment. And obviously our first president, George Washington, was at the front of that. Coming up on the other side, we're going to talk to the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon. It is the first of what we are calling Founding Fathers Friday here on the show, gearing up for the big 250th birthday celebration of our country. That is next on JR Morning. Well, you guys know I'm a history nerd. I absolutely love it. And as we approach the 250, we thought it would be a good idea to go back and revisit, learn about the people that set this whole thing up. Our founding fathers that created this blueprint for what would become this grand American experience, this thing that had never been done in this part of the world. And we start today with the guy, with George Washington. And I find him to be incredibly fascinating because his life story evolved in ways that I don't think he totally had expected when the British had control here in the United States. And I obviously am no expert, but thankfully we do have some out there. Lindsay M. Chervinsky is the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon and joins me this morning. It's so good to talk with you. Thank you for taking a couple of minutes with us this morning.
Absolutely. Happy to join you.
I want to start back because we know what George Washington did as part of the revolution and joining the revolution and then obviously becoming the first president. But I want to go back a little bit because his aspirations were always to be a higher ranking member of the British Army. And there were a lot of bumps along the way for him early in his military career that ultimately pushed him towards the revolution.
Yes, that's right. So Washington was the third born son. And I think that that's really important to remember because that meant that he had very little money and property that was going to come to him through his family. And he really had to find a way to advance himself through either the existing military options or his own merit. And so he tried to get a commission in the British Army and was unable to because he did not have the means to basically purchase an officer position. So he joined the Virginia Regiment and he ended up commanding a Virginia Regiment. But even after fighting with really incredible bravery in multiple different battles, that regiment was never treated the same as the British soldiers they were fighting alongside. And Washington wrote this great letter to the Lieutenant Governor, Robert Dinwiddie, saying, "We cannot conceive that just because we are Americans, we should be receiving second-class treatment." Mm. And so you can see him start to think about how being an American, and at that point, that was really just sort of like where you were born. He started to realize that that was not going to be equal citizenship as if he were British.
Mm. One of the battles that I don't think people talk enough about, again, early in his military career was Fort Necessity. It was, I believe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but that was one of the only battles that they surrendered in. And it was quite a slaughter for him. It was a relatively small battle, but at the same time, how did that then influence the way that he looked at leading soldiers, that he looked at how to build a regiment, build an army?
Yeah, it's a really important moment in Washington's career, and I would say global history as well, because he had come off an engagement in which the records are a little bit murky, but basically there was a French official that was killed, and whether or not George Washington's forces killed him or their native allies killed him is sort of up for debate. But he was killed and allegedly was trying to surrender. And so then the French forces and their native allies marched on Washington, and he selected a site to build a fort, and it was very poorly situated. It was in the lowlands, so it was going to flood once it rained, which it did. It was too close to the tree line, so sharpshooters could stand behind the trees and pick off soldiers. And ultimately, he had to surrender, and in doing so, he signed terms of surrender in which he acknowledged assassinating this French official. And he didn't read French, so he was relying on another translation. And that is really seen as the spark of the Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War, which was obviously a massive global conflict. And so he had a very important role in that. But for himself personally, he realized that many of his other soldiers and other officers had urged him to move. And he didn't listen to that advice. And he thought, you know, he was too proud, basically, to acknowledge that he needed to retreat. And that was a lesson he learned. And going forward, the reason it was one of the only times he surrendered is, even though he lost a lot of other battles, he always was quick to retreat if strategy demanded it, and not too proud to take a step backwards to fight to survive another day.
Mm. Let's fast forward a little bit. Once the revolution starts, and he came to the realization that he was not going to progress in the British Army to the standing that he would have liked. He decides to join the revolution, and there were a lot of questions about his leadership leading the military. Weren't there?
Yeah, you know, he did make some mistakes, especially in 1776. In the summer of 76, the army suffered a series of defeats and retreats across Long Island, New York, Manhattan, and ultimately up through New Jersey and down into Pennsylvania. And, you know, he made some cardinal sins. He, you know, split up his troops. He didn't appropriately survey the land to figure out if there was any back entrances to his position. You know, the kind of things that are sort of standard military fare. And he also had some enormous luck that covered various retreats at moments of real peril. And so there were people who were quite critical of his leadership. What I think is so important is, leading into 1777, he engineered the famous crossing of the Delaware and then the battles at Trenton and Princeton. And that was a hugely important symbolic victory and a great boost to morale. But then after that, the army was so loyal to him that even if Congress, you know, wanted to consider replacing him, they understood that they couldn't, because the army would disintegrate. And so they just basically started calling it Washington's army instead of the Continental Army. And after that, his leadership was really unchallenged.
We have just a 30 seconds or so left here. His decision to step away from the presidency, in his that farewell address, how did that change the course of history?
Well, it ensured we wouldn't have an elected king, because if he stayed in office for the remainder of his life, then so would his successors. And it established the peaceful transfer of power, which was really unseen at that point and is a bedrock of what it means to be a republic.
Lindsay M. Travinsky with the Washington Presidential Library in Mount Vernon. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. You're on my bucket list. I'm gonna come in one day, so I can't wait to see the place. And thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff, certainly. Coming up on the other side, we'll get you caught up on the headlines. We're also going to talk to the supervisor curator at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum. Also, Brother Gary Wegner joins us with the Capuchins. Big events coming up to support them. One is the loneliest number. Lloyd with the day off. He's recovering from his birthday celebration yesterday. And, of course, Jamie with some time off as well. So you're riding with me this morning, and it's good to have you. And, you know, one of the things that we have been looking for in when something would be popping off, it happened. It was a overnight session, an all-nighter by the Senate. They passed the $70 billion immigration reform package. It was backed by Donald Trump. So now Customs Enforcement, ICE, and Border Patrol operations, they get funding for the next 3 years. The measure advanced through a marathon votorama. It was a big political win for Donald Trump, Senate Republicans, who argued that the funding was necessary after Democrats refused to support immigration operations without broader policy reforms. That's when they were still in that partial government shutdown over DHS funding. Now it heads to the House, where it sounds like GOP leaders there are going to move it quickly. However, there are, I think this process showed that there are some real divisions within the party for Republicans. There were disputes over these controversial proposals, including a scrap the $1 billion ballroom project that has ballooned in price, the $2 billion anti-weaponization fund, nearly $2 billion anti-weaponization fund. And some Republicans are raising concerns about how these funds are going to be used. Democrats are going to capitalize on that infighting, obviously. And despite these internal tensions, there are still a number of issues that need to be dealt with. And I find it interesting that, you know, in a midterm election cycle, because we're in June now. So we are getting close here. You know, locally, we're going to vote in our primaries coming up in just a couple of months. But all of these decisions that are being made are going to have some sort of political ramification down the road come November. What that is, we don't know yet. But I don't think Republicans are in the strongest position right now. It's something to watch for. Also something that we are watching is the news yesterday that broke that Dylan Larkin, your captain of the Winged Wheelers, is requesting a trade after 11 years with the Red Wings. These reports were first brought by Elliot Friedman at Hockey Night in Canada, Darren Dreger at Sportsnet. We have not heard from Dylan Larkin himself, his representation. The team hasn't publicly commented on this as well. But Dylan Larkin has a no trade clause in his contract. What does that mean? Well, it means that he has to sign off on any deal that gets made. If there is a team that he doesn't want to go to, he can kill the deal. So he holds the cards here. But also, it is pretty clear, whether it was here or in Tampa Bay, Steve Yzerman will resist any sort of pressure to move a player unless the terms of that deal are favorable to his organization. So if there is a deal to be made, and by the way, I think there are a number of landing spots. I think the Free Press put out like five destinations that he could go to. Montreal, Anaheim, a couple spots. There are some other teams, Minnesota being another one. Teams that have young talent that they would deal. Now, here's where I don't think Steve Yzerman is going to get into any sort of mix. If we're dealing in draft picks and not players, I don't think that's something Steve Yzerman's interested in. I don't think he can be interested. You look at the production of Dylan Larkin, and no, I don't think he is a superstar player. I don't think he's even a top-line center on most teams. He is here, but he's 18th among NHL centers in scoring. He is top 60 in NHL scorers. So he's not an elite player. He's a wonderful player. He's probably a second-line center. So we'll watch that because that was pretty explosive news yesterday as well. By the way, Carolina in the Stanley Cup Finals, if you're watching that, they beat Las Vegas in overtime, game two in the Stanley Cup Finals. They tie that series up at one. Also, Port Huron Police, Michigan State Police have issued a missing advisory for a two-year-old girl taken by her biological mother during a home invasion. Zuri Armani Whitson Rich was last seen in the area of the 3100 block of Electric Avenue in Port Huron. Police sources were telling outlets that the home invasion happened at around 6:30 last night. Just a little girl, 2 years old. She was last seen wearing pink pajamas, and police say she was taken by her biological mother. They are looking for this person and this little girl. So if you have information, call 911, Port Huron Police. That's 810-984-8415. Any information. Got to find this little girl, certainly. Coming up on the other side, we're going to talk to Merle Lukey, the supervisor curator at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Library, gearing up for the 250. But first, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. One of the biggest challenges for small businesses, with some circumstances even posing existential risks, are late payments made by customers to the business, resulting in cash flow and cash on hand issues. And now a new study just published by the Kaplan Group, they're a commercial collection agency, shows more than half of payments due to publishers and platforms in the media and advertising space in 2025, for example, were made late. And the problem appears to be just getting worse. And it's not something unique to just the media and advertising space. The aggregated data found that the State of Freelance Work 2025 report from Remote reported that 85% of freelancers experience late payments at least some of the time, and 21% are paid late or not paid at all more than half the time. These results, combined with invoice-level analysis by Banzai that draws on data for more than 100,000 freelancers over a three-year period, revealed that 29% of all freelancer invoices are paid one or more days late. Female freelancers, interestingly, were found to receive late payments on 31% of invoices compared to just 24% for male freelancers. And interestingly, the study found that it's larger companies that are more likely to pay late to your business than smaller businesses, 51% versus 41%. Large clients are using extended payment terms as a working capital strategy at your expense. The Kaplan Group notes that some marketers now use 90-day or even 120-day terms for making payments. So what to do? Look, if you're a small business in particular, you need to be aware of the increasingly challenging playing field when it comes to managing your cash. You need to be prepared to be paid late in a meaningful number of cases. And to do that, you need to make sure you have a sufficient cash on hand position to hedge against these increasingly late payments due in from customers. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the Great Voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
You know, we are within a month of the bicentennial, the celebration of 250 years of this wonderful American experience. And while there has been certainly some ugly bumps along the way, I think there's one thing that we can look at this point in time and say, you know, we are always striving for more. We're always striving for better. And no matter what time in history, you do find those bumps along the way. But this experiment that we continue to be on continues to be a strong one and an exciting one as we get ready to celebrate 250 years. And of course, that in that span of time, we've had such wonderful leaders that have stood for something. And one of those leaders is, of course, right here from the state of Michigan and President Gerald Ford. And there are some unbelievable stories about Gerald Ford that I cannot wait to get into with Dr. Muriel Loki, who is the supervisory curator at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum. Doc, good morning. It's great to talk with you.
Great. It's great to be here. Thank you.
One of the things that I find most fascinating about Gerald Ford, and really it was the thing for me as a 37-year-old loves history that really got me looking into his life and what he did outside of everything that happened with President Nixon, was a story that a guy I actually know, he made this documentary, and it was called Black and Blue, the story of Gerald Ford and Willis Ward. Willis Ward played on the University of Michigan football team with Gerald Ford, and you go back to 1934, and they were getting ready to play a game against the Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets. And they would not play if Willis Ward was going to be in the game. So Willis Ward got benched, and Gerald Ford threatened to quit the team, not play in that game. But Willis Ward, who handled the situation unbelievably, had Gerald Ford play. And it showed me the type of man that Gerald Ford was and what he stood for all the way back in the early 30s.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that experience was shaped by his experience growing up in Grand Rapids. His high school experience and all the way forward. And I think coming into the presidency, he was really determined that he would, you know, continue to be a man of integrity. He would help restore trust to the presidency and help the nation heal from the wounds of Watergate and the Vietnam War and the different crises that the nation had faced.
Mm. But he wasn't always Gerald Ford, was he? He was given a different name at birth and then adopted that later on.
Yeah, so when he was born Leslie Lynch King Jr. His mother was married to Leslie Lynch King Sr. But when he was just a few months old, his mother left his biological father because he was violent. And so he took the really brave and courageous and unusual decision in the 1910s to leave her husband. She and her infant son, who was called Junior or Junie, moved to Grand Rapids, where she met Gerald Ford Sr. And so he went from being Junior King to Junior Ford. And then he eventually took his stepfather's name.
Mm. And of course, you fast forward, he spent many years as a lawmaker, but he never actually won any sort of national election. He became the vice president after Spiro Agnew resigned, and then obviously president once Richard Nixon resigned as well amongst the Watergate scandal. And he delivered, among all of the presidents in history, one of the lines that I remember the most, and that was, "Our long national nightmare is over." And then he took the step even further to pardon Nixon at a time when that was not politically advantageous to him. And many, I'm sure you would be able to provide some light on this, that may have cost him the next election. But at a time when there was great suffering in the country from a political perspective, he was the right man at the right time to set the train back on the tracks going in the proper direction.
Yeah, I think he went into the presidency very aware, you know, as you mentioned, that he had not been elected to the vice presidency or the presidency. So he recognized that he didn't necessarily have a mandate from the people to be president. But again, as I mentioned, he was really determined to help the country heal. So he took as his mandate this idea of helping restore trust to the presidency. He talks again and again about helping to bind the nation's wounds and helping the country heal. He felt very strongly that one way to do this was to pardon Richard Nixon rather than having kind of a drawn-out trial and continuing to rehash what had happened in Watergate. He felt it was really important for the country to be able to move on. So he, you know, did a lot of research. He consulted with aides and his attorneys and things like that to try to decide whether or not this was the right thing to do. But he felt very strongly that helping the country move on was important, and that pardoning Nixon was a way to do that, helping the country move on from Watergate. And he definitely did recognize that it might hurt his chances of running for election in 1976. People in his own party, his good friend Tip O'Neill, Democrat mm-hmm. Tip O'Neill, also warned him that it was going to hurt his election chances. But he felt like it was more important to try to face the moment in that time.
And that almost seems completely foreign nowadays, that would be the type of mindset. And again, we've had leaders like that in our past in 250 years. But at such a time of a national controversy and all of the investigations that were being done at that time, again, it's a character check on somebody like Ford.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is really what defines his presidency is striving to do what is right for the country rather than, any specific personal gain. Mm.
How did these events in his life, whether it was his time at the University of Michigan, or when he, the ship that he was on in World War II almost went down. How did these events shape his life?
Well, I think, as with anyone, all of his life experiences kind of help, build him up to the person that he is. I know, for example, his experiences in World War II really shaped how he approached his role in politics. He had gone into World War II being a fairly committed isolationist, believing that the United States should not be involved on the world stage, but his experiences in the war really changed his perspective there. So when he gets back to Grand Rapids in 1946 after the war, he decides that he's going to run for Congress to upset the local Republican representative, Bartell Jonkman, who was an isolationist. And Ford really ran on this platform of internationalism and having the U.S. more involved on the world stage. And so then that leads to his 25-year career in Congress. I think these experiences do help shape who he is as a person and also who he is as a politician.
What's a story that you think most people don't know about Gerald Ford that they should?
Let's see. Well, so one thing that I am pretty excited about right now is we, of course, are celebrating the semi-quincentennial by looking back on the bicentennial, which Ford was president for in 1976. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of really fun stories that kind of helped shape that moment. One thing that's been on my mind a lot recently, because we just had an exhibit open here called Waltzing with the Queen, is there's a moment when President Ford and Queen Elizabeth are dancing in the White House as the Marine Corps band is playing. You know, he's in his tux and she's in her very elegant yellow gown, which we have on display here right now. And they're laughing in this video that you can see of the two of them dancing. And they're laughing because the Marine Corps band, as soon as they started dancing, the band started playing "The Lady is a Tramp." It was just part of their set, and it wasn't, you know, planned or anything like that. But I think the fact that he is laughing and the Queen is laughing in this video really illustrates the humor that Ford brought to life and his presidency. You know, he didn't necessarily take things seriously. He was a very humble person, and, you know, recognized a good joke.
Yeah, no doubt, a good joke certainly. Dr. Morrell Loki, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. We hope people get to the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum and all the great work that you guys do. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you got it. More coming up on JR Morning. So riddle me this. You guys know I ain't no mathematician. I can barely help my son with his second grade math. It's a real travesty. But Michigan's new 24% wholesale marijuana tax that was designed to help fund road repairs is bringing in significantly less than what we expected it to. And why is that? Well, let's talk about it. Beth LeBlanc, the reporter at the Detroit News, joins us to talk about it. Beth, good morning. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Why is it that we are seeing a 67% less gathering of this tax revenue from this new wholesale tax on marijuana than we expected?
Yeah, so in the first quarter of the year, the Treasury Department says they've collected about $34 million in wholesale tax on on marijuana wholesale. What they were supposed to collect is about $100 million, because House Fiscal Agency analysis has said it should bring in about $420 million a year. So they're running far below projections for the first quarter, at least. And it's anybody's guess why that's happening. Now, the industry will tell you that, and they've been warning since the start, that if you put this additional wholesale tax on marijuana, you're going to have people not wanting to buy the really high tax marijuana and going to a legal means to buy their marijuana. And so they're saying this is kind of proof positive that is happening. The state is saying it's a little too early to tell whether there's more illegal activity than there once was. But it's not really clear to me why this is happening. The other thing that we might be seeing, and some of the industry has been saying that to prepare for the wholesale tax, they made a lot of purchases beforehand, mm-hmm. So that those purchases, like, you know, from grower to processor to cultivator or what have you, so that they'll be exempt from the wholesale tax. So they might be running through that marijuana now. But what we can see, even from separate statistics out of the Cannabis Regulatory Agency, is that marijuana sales as a whole in the first quarter are down. From 2024 and 2025. So it might be, you know, just a weird coincidence, or it might be what they're arguing, that this is proof that folks are going to illegal means instead of sticking with the legal market.
Yeah, and that was my question, is where are these people going? I have a hard time believing that they've just stopped. They've said, we're gonna be done here. So it does feel like they're going in different ways. What is the backup plan if this money doesn't end up showing up? And to your point, I think it's fair to say, well, they had a lot of upfront costs, and we may see a different number, a different percentage of that money coming in the next quarter. But that I don't think that provides any real hope that we're going to get to those numbers that we need to help fund the roads, for example.
Yeah. I mean, you know, definitely the thing that makes me think that's not the case is the fact that sales also across the board are down over the first quarter, not just this wholesale tax. But yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. Like, what happens? I would assume that we just have less money for roads, that, you know, there's only so many places that they can pull that money if they fall short in this marijuana tax. And it's a good question right now, especially as the legislature and the governor are negotiating next year's budget, which mm-hmm. will include a placeholder for that tax money to go toward roads. And if they are getting less revenue than they expected from that, it's going to be a real issue moving forward.
Well, and it's problematic for them because we were talking to leaders up on Mackinac Island, for example, and they were touting kind of the bipartisan efforts that it took to get this road funding deal. It was the most lucrative road funding deal that we've had in Michigan's history. We have, I mean, year after year after year underfunded our roads, and we see it every single day. And so they were touting this kind of bipartisan work for getting this deal done, and it's still falling short.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a lot of folks who are listening have to kind of understand how they make these predictions of how much it's going to bring in, right? There are fiscal agencies within the House and the Senate who are usually dead on, right? Like, they've been looking at tax revenue for longer than I've been alive. Mm-hmm. And they understand how it's going to come in, and they're surprised by very little. But the thing about marijuana, and the thing even about gambling in Michigan, or you know, in sports betting or online gambling, which was legalized around the same time marijuana was, is that they were dealing with a whole new revenue stream. And it's a relatively new revenue stream. It's only been around for like 6 or 7 years. So they're trying to make predictions based on a revenue stream that they have relatively less experience with. So that's the problem with taxing these new things like online gambling or sports betting or marijuana, is that we don't have as much familiarity with this market and how it will react to something like a wholesale tax.
It's a great point, but it's also a revenue stream that's unpredictable. Because, you know, yes, you know that when you go to fill up your gas, you're going to have to pay a certain percentage of that goes to the taxes. And that is baked in. What you don't know is how people are, or how frequently people are going on their apps and betting on a particular game, or how much they're betting on a particular game, or what their winnings are, or how many people are going to a marijuana dispensary to buy product. So it to your point with the lagging sales and just the unpredictability, it's a completely different tax revenue stream for them, which seems like is why it's so difficult to nail down. It's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and they probably could have, you know, if there wasn't there, it is just very, very difficult to nail down. And the other thing about this wholesale tax is it's not just based on consumption. It's based on the movement of that marijuana, mm-hmm, between, you know, cultivator, processor, grower. So that kind of tax is more difficult than just I'm paying a 6% sales tax when I check out. It definitely shows up on your receipt at the end, but it's more difficult to understand how this is all moving through the system.
Mm, really interesting. Beth LeBlanc, thank you. We appreciate your coverage of this, and it's something we're going to continue watch. Obviously, you know, we've got a lot of road repairs that need to be made here in the state of Michigan, and we're counting on this money. Thank you for your time this morning. Have a good weekend.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, by the way, it is Donut Day, National Donut Day. It was started by the Salvation.
Yeah,
it was started by the Salvation Army, and this goes back a long time. They were serving donuts to the soldiers on the front lines in France during World War I. They were called Donut Lassies back in 1938. So it is National Donut Day. In honor of National Donut Day, Jason, what is the donut of choice?
See, we were talking about this earlier. I'm not a big fan of jelly-filled donuts at all.
Okay.
I can do like a plain chocolate. I can do a powdered donut. But like, I'm not big on the punchkies and all that stuff.
Are you good on like a cider mill donut?
Oh yeah. Those are great.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Brian, donut of choice.
Oh, you gotta go with Boston cream.
Boston cream.
I'm not against the jelly. Look, I'm a fat guy. All donuts are friendly to me. I love all donuts.
I'm a peanut donut.
Those are good too. Yeah.
It's like a glaze with peanuts on the outside. You get the salty sweet. It's perfect.
I don't know.
It's a perfect combination.
The jelly donut, the texture, the oozing out when you bite into it. I'm just not a fan.
Jason is, you know, he despises jelly donuts.
I do.
I'm pretty sure Jason's a communist at this point.
Yeah, what's up with that, dude? Don't go down that road, Jason. Yeah.
No, Bryce Whitty.
7:44, time for Automotive Views with Mike Martinez. It's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Learn more at michiganbusiness.org.
The UAW strike against American Axle could lead to big headaches at General Motors. About 1,000 workers are off the job in Three Rivers as the union fights for better wages and health benefits. The axles they normally make there go into Chevy Silverados and GMC Sierras, among other GM trucks. The automaker reportedly has a 2 to 3 week supply of those parts on hand, meaning the walkout would need to last longer than that to have an impact. But if it does, the strike could cripple key GM products at a time when it's trying to gain ground on Ford, which has dealt with its own pickup inventory issues. Workers deserve fair wages. They reportedly top out around $22 per hour today, even less than they made before the Great Recession. That needs to change, and the union will likely fight hard, given a good outcome could help UAW President Sean Fain as he faces re-election later this year. But for GM, it's simply one more headache amid a turbulent time for the industry. With this week's Automotive View, I'm Mike Martinez with Automotive News.
Well, it's WJR's Tim McGraw VIP experience. It's your chance to rock when country music legend Tim McGraw brings his Pawn Show Guitar Tour to Pinon Music Theater August 28th, and you could win a pair of premium pavilion tickets, transportation courtesy of Metro Cars, and $100 to Buddy's Pizza. All you got to do to enter is download the free WJR mobile app, find the secret keyword, and then text it to 800-859-0957. Download the free WJR mobile app, find the secret keyword, and then text it to 800-859-0WJR. More information is available at WJR.com. And that's going to be a great show, great event. Speaking of great events, the Capuchins have some great events on tap this month. And we're always happy to be joined by Brother Gary Wegner, the executive director of the Capuchin Soup Kitchen. Brother Gary, good morning. It's good to talk with you.
Good morning, Chris. Good to be here with you.
You guys are going to have a busy month. So you've got the Capuchin Super Summer Celebration at Comerica Park on June 13th. Then the next day, a Gouda evening at the Retreat in Washington, Michigan. And then on the 15th, the Feast of St. Antonio. So it's going to be a jam-packed month for you guys.
It's kind of a triple play for us.
Yes, it is.
Especially because this Sunday we have CSK Day at Comerica Park with the Tigers.
Awesome. How important are these events? Because what you guys do is so important to our community. How important is it to get other people involved? I have to imagine they're willing and ready on the call.
Well, I think they're important because, first of all, they help us do what we do, which is to provide about 1,000 meals a day to our guests who come to the Capuchin Soup Kitchen, both at Connor and Meldrum, and our Shopper's Choice Food Pantry, which provides grocery shopping experience for so many of our guests. We need, like anyone else, we need to pay for the groceries, and these events help us do that.
Remind us what is all provided or available with your organization, because yes, you are feeding the hungry, but it's so much more than that.
We have our Jefferson House program, which helps indigent men for 9-month residential drug and alcohol treatment. Earthworks Urban Farm, which grows a lot of the food for the Meldrum Kitchen especially, and also for the local neighborhood. We have our rope program with the On the Rise Cafe at the Solanas Casey Center, and which has men who have either previously been incarcerated or completed a drug or alcohol program, at least a 30-day one somewhere else, and it's a 1-year job training program, helps them fill in the gaps of their resume.
I remember when Jamie Lloyd and I were in to volunteer with you guys a few months ago. I was talking to a gentleman who was having lunch, and he was talking about his experience with the Capuchins and how he was in a bad way, and he was addicted to substances, and he found his way to you and credited all the work that was done in your facilities as a way to break that cycle, to find his way to God. And it was a wonderful testament to all of the work that you and your staff does to truly help people that need it.
Thank you, Chris. You know, I always say I have the best job at the soup kitchen because I get thanked a lot for what really other people have done or are doing. And I get to thank people for what they are doing or have done. And you know, that's a pretty good job description.
It is a pretty good job description. That's exactly right. How can people get involved, whether through volunteering or attending these events that benefit the Capuchins?
Well, they can go to our website, cskdetroit.org, to volunteer for the events. They can also go to our website to purchase tickets for the Tigers game. Mm-hmm. And they are on a 3-game winning streak.
They're on a heater.
So hopefully by the time it's our day on Sunday, they'll be going for their 6th straight.
That's exactly right.
So now's the time to get on board and to get on board with supporting the Soup Kitchen. And that's at cskdetroit.org/Tigers. For the Super Summer Celebration, show up at Comerica Park at 7:30 p.m. There's no admission to get into the park. And music, food, there are raffle tickets, which, of course, need to be purchased, $5 each. Ahe Jewelers, the Ahe family has, this is the 45th year that the Ahe family has been doing that. Mm. And on Monday, we have Antonio's, Feast of St. Anthony at Cucina Italiana locations. And, you know, it's a free buffet, or donations only asked, which is great. I have talked to some family sometimes who I think it might be the only time that they maybe get to an actual restaurant, and that's kind of good. Mm-hmm. And then there's other people who are regulars and then like to support us. And then, of course, a Gouda evening is on Sunday night at Capuchin Retreat to support our retreat center. And those tickets are $75. And it's just you can go to capretreat.org to find more information on that. So we're it's going to be a busy Saturday through Monday for us.
In the best way,
Sunday.
Yeah, in the best way possible. Brother Gary Wagner, thank
Absolutely.
You so much. God bless you and everything that you and your staff are doing at the Capuchin Soup Kitchen in Detroit. We appreciate you, and have a great weekend. We'll talk again very soon.
Thank you, Chris. You too.
Yeah, you got it. Meanwhile, there's some rumors on who could be the new president at Michigan State University. Remember, Kevin Guskowitz stepped away. He cited some of the trustees on the university's board as a reason to leave MSU for Clemson University. And one of the names being bandied about was former U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow. She says, "I am a Spartan through and through," she told the Detroit News yesterday, "but I am not interested in being interim or permanent president. Many people have encouraged me to do it, but she says she is not interested. After she left Congress, she joined Liberty Partners Group. They're a strategic consulting and lobbying firm that was co-founded by a former Florida senator as a policy group. So Debbie Stabenow, you can cross Debbie Stabenow's name off the list to be the next president at Michigan State University. 8 o'clock hour coming up. We're heading to the zoo, all that and more. All right, 8 o'clock hour. It's a Friday. It's National Donut Day. I don't know what else you want at this point. It's perfect. It's a perfect day. The sun is shining in downtown Detroit. Lloyd Jackson with the day off. Jamie's off. So you're riding solo with me. And the big news yesterday that broke locally is that Dylan Larkin has requested a trade. Now, we haven't heard from him. We haven't heard from his representatives. We haven't heard from the team. But Elliot Friedman and Darren Dreger, they're NHL reporters, they broke the story yesterday. And here's what I'll tell you. Whether it's true or not, this if you have been watching the Stanley Cup Finals between Carolina and Las Vegas, I think it's pretty obvious that the Red Wings are not at that level. They're actually not really even close. And that's problematic. And I think the concern here is that you have, I don't want to say wasted, but the prime years of Dylan Larkin's career, and by the way, he's only 30. So he's going to have a lot of years left. And he's under contract now till I think 2031. And he's got a cap hit of $8.5 million or whatever it is. The realities are Dylan Larkin's production is not that of a top-line center, which is the role that he plays here. He's actually probably more of a second-line center. And he's 18th in NHL scoring among centers. He's top 60 in NHL scorers overall for forwards. So the production isn't there. Now, if a trading partner comes along, and by the way, Dylan Larkin, if this is real and Dylan Larkin were to be traded, he would be an absolute hot commodity. He would be the value is there for Dylan Larkin. He doesn't have a history of severe injuries. Yes, he gets banged up here and there, misses a couple weeks, whatever it is. But he's a pretty reliable player. You know what you're going to get out of Dylan Larkin. So for a team that has a lot of young assets, that's going to be really, really valuable when they want to make a push. And there are a number of teams out there that have a lot of young talent that would benefit greatly from a Dylan Larkin being on their team and would certainly push them over the hump of being not just a playoff team, but being a real contender. So this is true, not true, whatever. But here's the facts is Dylan Larkin has a no trade clause in his contract. What does that mean? It just means he has full control. So if there is a trade proposal on the table, and let's say you want to send him to Utah, he can say, ixnay on the mammothe. I ain't going. And he has that right. Now, if they want to send him to Montreal or the Kings or the Wild, that are all probably more valuable trade destinations for him, and then he can pull the trigger on that. But Steve Yzerman is not going to just trade Dylan Larkin away because Dylan Larkin may want to be traded. The return is going to have to be there for Steve Yzerman to pull that trigger, and it would certainly shake things up. But the shame of it all is Dylan Larkin is a Detroit kid. He is everything that Aiden Hutchinson is. Grew up here, born here, played college hockey here, and then got drafted to his team. So it's a wonderful story. I wish the ending would have been written differently, if this is indeed true. I wish Dylan Larkin was able to hold up, 35 pounds of the greatest trophy in sports here in Detroit. In that jersey, and maybe that's in the cards, but according to these reports, Dylan Larkin wants out, and it's something that we're going to continue to follow. Meanwhile, Donald Trump said that he would be open with meeting Mujtaba Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, if ongoing efforts to reach a deal to end this Iranian conflict are successful. He said he would be honored to meet the supreme leader as part of these negotiations, saying that his focus on securing an agreement that would prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons and ensuring the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. And this would come, as we sit here today, heightened tensions. There is a memorandum of understanding on the table that has not been agreed to yet. But the president also said, I understand there might be some hard feelings because they carried out military strikes that, killed his father, for example. But there is no deal yet. There is nothing hard and fast signed in place that would facilitate this type of meeting just yet. And again, remember, nobody has seen Mujtaba Khamenei since he was elevated to supreme leader. So we don't really exactly know his condition. We don't exactly know the details of this deal at this point. Also, the Senate last night, in a Votorama all-night session that was backed by Donald Trump, passed a $70 billion immigration enforcement package that would fund customs ICE enforcement. It would fund Border Patrol operations for the next 3.5 years. And this comes after the deliberations around the partial government shutdown and DHS funding, which was pretty simple for the Democrats, is that we're not going to put more money towards ICE and CBP until there are serious reforms. Well, they passed a half-hearted measure of DHS funding, and so it did not include funding for ICE and CBP. They were already previously being funded, so they weren't necessarily impacted by the partial government shutdown. But this also does expose some real fissures within the Republican Party, because there were disputes over the Ballroom Project. There were disputes over the anti-weaponization fund. And Republicans are going, well, hold on, how is this money going to be spent And of course, Democrats are gonna hop on that, certainly, which as they should. That's the game. But the bulletproofness of Donald Trump's not base out here, but inside Congress is there are some real cracks in that foundation. And that's not good for him when you consider where his approval rating is. It's not good for him when you consider what's going on in Iran. It's not good for him when people go to the gas station. And all of those things play a role into what we may see in November. Also, Detroit's housing market has gone really a complete 180. And no, there's still a lot of work to do. Certainly, we haven't arrived at our destination. But home values now in the city are worth more than twice what it was in 2016, a decade. There is a new report on median home value prices rising sharply from the low $30,000 range to more than $75,000. It is the fastest growing large housing market in the country. And, well, we've come a long way post-bankruptcy. There's been demand. There has been a ton of revitalization done downtown, and it's bleeding over into the neighborhoods now. And there is sustained investments across the city. And so it is absolutely huge, huge to see these numbers where they're at now. It's fantastic. Coming up on the other side, we take a trip to the Detroit Zoo. It is certainly one of the top attractions in our area. So we're going to talk to Dr. Haley Murphy, the executive director and CEO of the Detroit Zoo, coming up next. But no matter where you look, we talked about it, rising costs are hitting you hard. And when you're forced to make these tough choices, keeping the light on, keeping the air on, it should never be one of them. Consumers Energy is stepping up, giving back $5 million to assistance agencies and supporting efforts to increase energy assistance dollars for families who need it by 50%. And with personalized energy savings programs, you can take the steps to start reducing your energy bills today. So count on Consumers Energy for that support. Learn more at consumersenergy.com/help. You know, the Detroit Zoo draws more than 1.3 million visitors annually. As a result, they are a major economic driver here in Southeast Michigan. Certainly as a result, the communities around the Detroit Zoo benefit from that. And there's a ton going on there. Let's talk about it. Dr. Haley Murphy is the executive director and the CEO of the Detroit Zoo. Doc, good morning. It's good to have you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, there's a lot going on. Let's start with the herb discovery trails that have been reopened. That is always a highlight when you get to the zoo.
Yeah. So this is an amazing 7-acre experience that was designed to really get people inspired about protecting wildlife and the natural world. We also wanted a place where families could come and enjoy nature outside together. So it's a brand new experience. Like I said, it's 7 acres full of fun things to do. We've got Stingray Cove where people can feed and touch stingrays and bamboo sharks, if you can believe it. We've got the barnyard, which is goats and chickens. You can go in and brush the goats, alpacas, donkeys. And then an amazing elevated treetop canopy walk where people can run along through the treetops, enjoy family time together, but also exercise and fresh air. So we're so excited about it.
Well, I wish I had somebody from your staff walk around with my kids and I, because they have a ton of questions, and I always give them half-hearted answers because I don't always know. But that's what's so great about what you've cultivated at the zoo and has really continued over the years, because you focus so much on the care of these animals, no matter how big or small they are, and all the conservation efforts that you guys do to make sure that they continue to flourish.
Well, thank you. Yes, we absolutely do. Every experience we design is experienced with animal well-being and animal welfare in mind. And we're also a huge conservation organization. And so we're looking at how we protect the wildlife, not only in Southeast Michigan, but around the world. And we have a top-notch education department. So they're designing programming throughout this region, not only at the zoo and the Belle Isle Nature Center, but also in school programming before and after school through our camp programs. Really, our educators believe in us being a living classroom. And so, yeah, you're right. Bring your family here, bring your children, bring your grandchildren if you have grandchildren, and they will learn about the natural world in a fun and engaging way. And that's what we inspire to do every single day.
You know what I've always wondered? The type of network that you are a part of with other zoos across the country, because, you know, oftentimes we'll hear, oh, we're going to send this animal over here, or we're going to go this way with it. You know, 3 weeks ago, you welcomed a new giraffe from Utah. So to talk about the type of relationship that you have with other zoos with all of the conservation efforts in mind.
Well, thanks for asking that. It's super important. We're part of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which really set the gold standard for how we take care of animals throughout AZA. Zoos and aquariums, and it's really an effort across the country and across the world to conserve the genetics of these endangered species so that we can have them for our future generations. So we cooperate across these accredited institutions to make sure that animals are going to places that have very high quality animal welfare, but also they're going and coming here to breed, to really guarantee that genetic diversity so that our kids, grandkids, and so forth will be able to enjoy these animals. And we take an immense pride in being a leading conservation and animal welfare organization.
Well, and it takes a lot of money to run the type of experiences that you offer to people that come to the zoo. Talk about your summer fundraiser. This is a signature event for you guys. It's Sunset at the Zoo. How important are these events? And tell us a little about it.
Yeah, thanks. Sunset at the Zoo is coming up, actually, Thursday, June 18th from 7 to 11. Incredibly important. It's our biggest fundraiser of the year. You know, we're a nonprofit organization, so we rely on donations coming in, philanthropic donations from foundations, private money coming in. We also have a lot of public support and government support. So to run a successful nonprofit, remember we have over 2,000 animals from over 200 species. So it takes a lot of resources to run an organization like this. We're very complex. And Sunset at the Zoo is not only a fundraiser, but honestly, it's a way for us to show off the zoo to this 21 and over crowd in the evening and have some of those encounters really inspire that, inspire that love of nature and realize our impact to the region.
Yeah, it might be a little more economically feasible to feed birds. Probably a little more difficult feeding the lions, I'd imagine.
I don't know. If you come see our cassowary Neo, you'll realize that some birds can be very large.
fair. Good point. It's wonderful what you guys are doing. And I have always loved coming to the zoo when I was a kid. And now to experience that through my son's eyes is so much fun. And asking all the same questions and just being really curious. And you know, you are certainly springboarding this next generation to be conservationists and thinking about taking care of our planet, taking care of the animals that live here, too. It's wonderful what you guys do. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Haley Murphy. We appreciate it. And we'll talk again very soon.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it and hope to see you at the zoo soon.
Yes, we will. We're there quite often in the summer. You know what's great is like there's, especially with the Detroit Zoo, and I've been to some zoos that are, you know, they're smaller. They try their hardest, just trying my hardest. But the Detroit Zoo is totally different. I mean, it is a cut above. It is a class above. And what they do for our community is absolutely fantastic. You know, this Dylan Larkin news, I just can't get over it, because the thing that I keep going back to with the Dylan Larkin news, like, it has been the reaction that I've seen online. Like, people are absolutely befuddled by this news. And I'm not that surprised. And shameless plug, if you watch Blaine Fowler and I on Hockey Talk on our social media channels, Blaine Fowler from Blaine and Lauren in the Morning over on 96.3 WDVD, our sister station, just a room next door. We've talked about if the Red Wings didn't make the playoffs, which obviously they didn't, what was going to happen to this team? Do you blow it up? Do you go a different route? And the realities are, if you do that, if you decide to go down the route of, well, we need an overhaul. First of all, it's a real bummer because we've accomplished nothing since Kenny Holland left, and there's been no run. There's been one playoff appearance, and we just haven't we haven't been able to gain any traction. Well, there are a lot of pieces on this team that aren't going to fetch a king's ransom in a trade. Well, one of the players that probably would is Dylan Larkin. And so if you've watched Dylan Larkin on the international stage, in the Olympics, the Four Nations tournament, things like that, this dude is a leader. This dude wants to win. He is a competitor. And if that's not happening here, it's not. I'm not just not totally surprised that he wants out, if these reports are true. Coming up on the other side, speaking of Detroit teams, the Tigers are on a heater. They've won three in a row over the Tampa Bay Rays, and now Seattle's on deck. We'll talk to Dan Dickerson.
I'm just trying my hardest.
Yeah, you'd rather not be 13 games under 500 at this point in the season, but that's where the Tigers find themselves. They did sweep the Tampa Bay Rays, which was nice to see. And now on tap, little home series against the Seattle Mariners, 6:40 first pitch tonight. Framber Valdez on the bump for the Tigers. Dan Dickerson joins us to talk about it, the voice of your Detroit Tigers. Dan, it's always good to talk with you, my friend. Thank you.
Yeah, good morning, guys.
I want to start here because obviously the season has not gone how we had wanted, expected, those things. But they have been bitten by injuries to some really important positions. Obviously, Tarek Skubal, Justin Verlander on his return to the Tigers. That has obviously impacted this team and where A.J. Hinch thought they'd probably be at this point in the year.
Yeah, I mean, and we just saw what the return of just two hitters, but it was two right. of their top four hitters meant to the offense in Carpenter and Torres. I'm not saying that's the only reason they click, but having two guys back kind of lengthens the lineup and puts guys in spots where they maybe can thrive, allows A.J. Hinch to get his matchups better. And the Tigers scored 25 runs and hit 10 home runs against Tampa. Now you're getting Skubal back, you're getting Mize back, you're getting Verlander back. Trey Melton has been tremendous in three starts. He just went 7 and 8 innings, yeah. which no Tiger starter has done in back-to-back starts. This rotation could be really powerful. And let's face it, it was ranked number one in the American League going into the season. Skubal, Mize, Verlander, Valdez, Melton. That's a pretty good rotation. And I think the only way you're going to get on a roll and get back in this thing, you got to get on a roll, right? And if the offense perks up and just gets back to being a pretty solid offense with this rotation, they could get on a roll. Mm-hmm. And the only thing you look at right now is let's get back to 500, see what happens. But they do have a chance to do that.
Yeah, and you're right. I think the return of the sticks makes – I mean, they look completely different with Gleyber Torres back in the lineup over the last few games. And they scored a ton of runs against one of the best teams in the American League.
And it just reminded you. It's like, well, those two guys aren't going to say they're not the saviors for the offense. No. But what it allows AJ to get the matchups that he wants more often.
No doubt.
And again, it was also allows these guys have been working on. I mean, working. It was 30 games of futility. They were averaging under 3 runs a game for 31 games. You knew it was in there because they were a top 5 offense last year. It was amazing that it couldn't. But these guys come back. Not a coincidence, I don't think, that the offense broke out.
All right, so just a few days ago, Tarek Skubal threw 4 innings in a simulated game while they were in Tropicana Field. This guy's an alien. I mean, we were looking at multiple months, 3 months of him potentially not returning. Where is he at in his recovery process?
Well, they'd like him to start. So Verlander started for Toledo in Iowa a few days ago. I think they would love to have Tarek start for Toledo against Iowa this weekend. The forecast does not look great. So I think they're trying to figure out where he's going to start on Sunday. Hmm. Ideally, you start against AAA hitters, right? Because a better chance of building your pitch count, getting 5 or 6 ups, whatever the goal is. Against an A-ball team, he might throw 35 pitches.
Right.
So
I feel so for I those hitters, that, Dan. My God.
So, and that's why they do the simulated games, because it's a controlled environment and you can get the pitch count to where you want it to be, but you do need live competition. Yeah. So that's why they do it this way. It's a very, you know, it's a great way to bring guys back. I think Tarek will start somewhere on Sunday. just looking at the forecast this morning, it doesn't look good for Des Moines. So he'll start somewhere, and I'm of the belief, and they're not saying anything, of course, that, you know, they're going to go day by day.
Sure.
I think his next start after that, wherever it is on Sunday, will be in a Tigers uniform, which is remarkable because, you know, 2 to 3 months was the standard. New procedure, better procedure, less invasive, quicker recovery, and it'll be amazing to have him back, I think, you know, within 10 days.
You know how fans can be. Fans can be very fickle, and you know, I've talked to a lot of folks, and the overarching thing that I get from everybody, you know, that might be a little bit down on this team, that are a little disappointed, everybody seems to trust A.J. Hinch. I haven't found anybody that says, boy, I just don't think A.J.'s got this thing going in the right direction. What has been his demeanor through this slide here?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It never changes. And he's, you know, he works at that, but he's always been that way because he knows how he walks into that clubhouse every day matters.
Yeah.
And it can't be easy. That's as tough a stretch as you're ever going to go through as a manager, losing 21 of 25, but it's the relentless preaching of how do we win today's game that you can't bring yesterday's game into today. Well, he knows that it's weighing on them.
Yeah.
He knows exactly what's going on, but I'm telling you, it's special. It's a special ability to get guys to, okay, focus on today's game, as bad as it's been for a couple of days, a couple of weeks. And that pays off in the end. I mean, because you're in it and you're watching, you're like, God, this is killing me. I'm just talking about the game.
Right.
You know, to be able to deflect some of that away from the players and make sure they're still working on what they need to work on that day to win that game, that's an incredible ability. There's so much that goes into it. He is 24/7 baseball, and no one knows the game at a higher level. The way he manages a game, the way he puts the pieces together, the strategy involved, the psychology degree comes into play every day with him.
No doubt.
He is. There's nobody better in the game. I watch him every day, but I'm always impressed because we've seen some of these stretches. Well, every year you see a stretch like this, and how he handles it is really kind of the key to, if there's going to be a turnaround, I think there will be, it's because of how he directs and leads this team.
I don't think that we're headed towards a scenario where we've got multiple all-stars kind of like we have the last couple of years. Who do you think sticks out that'll be the representative, at least through this point of the season?
Dylan Dinger is having an amazing year. I mean, he's gotten better in small but important ways, you know, defensively. Because he just keeps working on his game, but how he calls the game and his defensive skills. And he has hit some of the biggest home runs and just continues to deliver at the plate.
What is he, 14 or 15?
I think he's up to 14 now. Yeah, that three-run home run the other day was huge.
Yeah.
Two outs in the fourth inning to turn a 3-2 game into a 6-2 game. So, I mean, to me, he's the one who just jumps out because he's so outstanding. Kevin McGonigal could make it. Heck, he's already got a 3 WAR.
He's something else.
He's playing short. He's playing third. He's playing it at a very high level, and he's just every day so consistent. Even if the average may fall a little bit, he's going to give you a good at bat. He's still walked more than he struck out.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. And to put him and Torres at the top 1-2 with a combined on base of like 380 right now, it's going to drive this Tigers offense.
Yeah,
but those are the two that kind of stand out right now.
Yeah, it shows you how much trust that they have in the kid. It's something special. Dan Dickerson, always appreciate it. Thank you. Have a good call. Have a nice weekend, and we'll talk soon.
All right, Chris. Always good talking with you.
Yeah, you got it. That's Dan Dickerson here on WJR. Coming up, we got a sweet deal for you on the other side. It's JR Morning. You know, I've been so busy. I have not golfed once this year. I know. Don't shake your head at me, Brian. Don't do that.
I'm only one trip ahead of you. I've golfed once.
But good for you.
I got a couple on the horizon here.
Very good. I'm happy for you. But I've not been once, and generally when that happens, my game suffers. So I love to go to a golf simulator. Why? Because you can analyze your ball speed, your club head speed, your launch angle, which I inevitably will probably do nothing with, and my game will continue to still stink. But it's a great indicator of where you are. And back nine is a perfect spot to check out all of that information. Maybe you just want to go if it's raining and you get rained out, you want to still play your round with your friends. Again, back nine's the spot. And Leonard Fox is the owner of Back Nine Golf in West Bloomfield and in Clarkson and joins us this morning. Leonard, it's good to have you.
Hey, great to be on.
Let's talk a little bit about what you guys do, because these are cutting edge simulators that you have in your stores.
Yes, we have the Full Swing technology, which is backed by the TGL. So you have, you know, the great Tiger Woods is behind it, John Rahm, and some other PGA golfers, as well as Patty Mahomes and Josh Allen are all involved. They're ambassadors or investors in the company. So the simulator is updated probably every 2 weeks with data to keep it tight. So we do some great things there. As I heard you guys said, you haven't got out this year. It's a great facility. We kind of make it like a country club, but also you can come in and just pay for regular bay hours. So it's an inviting environment.
Let's talk about it, because you've got a wonderful deal for our listeners, and I want you to lay it out for us.
Yes, we have the suite deal. Normally it's $50 an hour. We're selling it for $25 an hour. It'll be great for Father's Day, or even great for the golfer that is driving by, heading to the golf course, and the golf course may not have a range. They could go out, warm up, and like you said earlier, understand the data. Once you dig into the data, you can actually get on the course and try to figure out what you was doing wrong earlier and then tweak it and maybe have a great round.
Key word there is try. I think you hit it right on the head, Leonard. I think you hit it right
on
the head.
I'm just trying the hardest.
It's a finicky game, but when you've got this type of data, you can look at it, and certainly it will improve your game. It's a fantastic deal that you have for our listeners. That goes live at 9 o'clock, so you go to WJR.com, click the Sweet Deals banner off to the right. I'm looking at the site right now. It goes live in just under 6 minutes. So you can head on over to WJR.com, click that Sweet Deals banner, and it'll be there for you. How have these simulators improved your game?
It's a funny story. I just played in a tournament with Michigan great Glenn Rice.
Oh, yeah.
And normally I finish at the bottom half. This year I took second.
Oh, my.
A lot of hard work during the winter. Surprised the whole crew. So I'm very excited.
Good for you. Leonard, we appreciate you. We appreciate you hooking our audience up with this deal. $25 gets you $50, and that's a heck of a deal, and you can really go and improve your game. Leonard Fox, we appreciate you. Best of luck. We'll talk again very soon, I'm sure.
I hope so. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. That's Leonard Fox, the owner of Back Nine Golf in West Bloomfield and in Clarkston. You know, I was just watching Fox News, and they were talking about how now is the time when students go ahead and find their summer jobs. First of all, my little guy, Henry, yesterday, I picked him up. It was his last day of school yesterday. Finished preschool threes, right? And I'm like, what are you going to do all summer? You have to do something. Let's get you a job. Let's get you contributing to this.
Are we going to have him do chores?
I don't even want to get started on that road.
Okay.
I have tried to get these kids to do chores. They do nothing.
Is there are you incentivizing them?
All right.
I used to do dishes for a dime when I was really little. I remember that.
You need a better agent, Jason.
Here's how this started.
Hey, that was the 80s. Come on. That was a good deal.
Here's how this started. A couple of years ago, Jake says, I want a PlayStation 5.
Okay.
And we said, all right, we'll get one, but you have to save $100 of your own money.
Wow.
So every month we'll give you $10 or whatever, every 2 weeks, whatever it was. But you got to take your plates to the sink. You got to take your laundry to the whatever. You got to get your pajamas on. But we don't want to remind you. right? You got to just do all of those things. So, of course, nothing gets done. We always have to remind him. He does it. He saves them. He saves. Starts saving his money. Well, then he starts telling Grandma and Grandpa on all the sides, hey, I'm saving money for a PlayStation 5. And they're like, well, here's $20.
Well, that plan backfired.
Here's $10. And I'm like, no, that's not what this is supposed to be. We're trying to teach him responsibility. And so he got it much quicker, and then we had to buy the stupid PlayStation. But now they want another gaming thing, and it's like $500. And I'm like, well, I'm not paying for any of it. Jeez. You guys are saving all of it, and I don't care how long it takes.
Yeah.
And so there is that, but they just, you know, they don't care that much, so I don't care that much. But they don't do any chores. So my question to you guys, what was your summer job? What was your first job?
So my first job, I was a banquet server at Hillcrest in Clinton Township, and it's a Meijer now. But we had a problem. It was the early 90s, and Kid Rock used to keep crashing weddings and parties there.
that's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Brian? Jason?
I was a bag boy, Oak Ridge Market. Renee, you know what I'm talking about. Prospect and 13. I had to wear the tie, the dress shirt. That was
very good. Brian?
I was a bus boy at an ice cream parlor was my first job.
Good gig. I was a sandwich artist at Subway. Shout out to all my sandwich artists out there. Yep. It's what we called ourselves. All right, that's going to do it for us. Kevin Eats coming up next. Have a good weekend.